Susan, Butcher Box to the rescue. The other night we had some friends over for dinner and we had no idea what to make. And I was like, guess what? We have a freezer full of meat. So my husband went down and thawed out some chicken from Butcher Box and made the best coq au vin that we've had in a long, long time.
Yeah, you'd have been screwed without Butcher Box because I know you ain't got no time to go to the store right now.
That's true. I don't have time to go shop for meat or pick out the meat or find the best quality, low-priced meat. So ButcherBox does all of that for me.
So, true story, my husband's workplace has a Slack channel called Smoked Meats. And I know you can't like win a workplace conversation, but he is now because with Butcher Box, his great cuts of meat to the door, they can cook up and take photos of for his workmates.
I love ButcherBox, and I think other people would too.
ButcherBox is the ultimate convenience, delivered right to your doorstep, free shipping always, with curated, customized box plans.
It's 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork, raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood.
There are a variety of high-quality cuts at an amazing value with exclusive membership deals. They also provide recipe inspiration, guides, tips, and hacks.
Sign up at butcherbox.com/proof and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional 20% off.
Choose salmon, chicken breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/proof and use code PROOF to choose your free for a year offer. Plus, get $20 off your first order.
Hey everyone, before we continue with this episode, I want to tell you about another podcast. Have you ever wondered what it feels like to watch your house burn down or be attacked by an alligator or learn that your spouse hired someone to kill you? If you're dying to know, then What Was That Like is the podcast for you. What Was That Like is filled with real stories about the most surreal experiences of people's lives. On the show, host Scott Johnson dives deep with his guests into the unbelievable situations they found themselves in, like animal attacks, plane crashes, winning The Price is Right, and more. The show brings you tons of completely surreal, completely true stories, all told through the lens of the person who actually experienced it.
Check out some of these episodes about wild and gripping stories to gain some insight on what it was like to, say, be a professional bridesmaid or lose a leg in a shark attack.
Susan, I think you'd be a really good professional bridesmaid.
And you'd be really good at losing a leg in a shark attack.
Oh, gee, thanks.
So if you want to hear some disturbing and inspiring firsthand stories, you need to check out What Was That Like? Every story is thoroughly researched and fact-checked, so you know even the most bizarre tales are someone's reality. Listen to What Was That Like on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hello and welcome to this week's Sidebar. We're here to discuss episode 14 of season 2 of Proof. We're here recording live from a hotel gym room.
It's true. A few minutes ago, though, we were in the hotel. I was in Susan's room, and she was recording VO underneath a blanket tent that we made.
We made a blanket fort to record VO.
I'm sorry I wasn't invited to see that.
What happens if someone walks in here right now?
They will be scared and turn around and walk away.
So this week on the show, we heard from a few witnesses. We also heard from Jared Conway a little bit, from our one very brief phone conversation with him. I remember when it happened, Jacinda, we were both like, that's not what we expected him to sound like.
No, I'm not sure what I expected, but I don't know, you could tell from the little bit of the recording I got. He was also very angry, so his voice seemed like high-pitched and angry, but he would not engage. I tried to like slow down and see if he would talk, and he just hung up on me.
Yeah.
He wanted to control the flow of information, and you were disrupting that pattern for him.
We actually had one listener write in this week, though, about that conversation we had with him, or rather the letter that followed up after. Jacinda, what did that comment say?
Oh, yeah. So we did. We had someone write in who said their father, I believe, worked a lot with the prison system and inmates, and that his understanding of expiration date does not mean suicide. It means their release date. So,
but he's nowhere close to a release date.
Almost a decade away. So I still think he was trying to subtly threaten. I don't know. It's hard to say though. Like maybe he doesn't know. Maybe Jared doesn't know that we know when he actually is up for possible release.
I also think with this guy, you have to take into account that he's trying to control every aspect of the conversation, and everything he says is designed for drama. And I don't know if we'll ever know exactly what he meant, but it was supposed to catch your attention and get us talking about it like we are right here.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So 1 point to Jared.
Yeah. Well done.
Well done. I also think, though, that he might underestimate who we are and what we know and how much research and time we're putting into this.
We also heard this episode from Karen Greer. That's Eric Greer's mother. And she talked about what her son was like and her last conversation with him, which, I mean, I can't imagine having that be your last phone call with your child.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. She's like, Eric, I can't come get you, but just wait.
Half an hour.
30 minutes.
I'll come get you
30 minutes. And
he couldn't wait for whatever reason. There's a lot we don't know about what happened to Eric. And there's no reason to think it's necessarily connected directly to what happened in this case, in Renee's case. But it is possible that there is a connection in the sense that whatever happened that day, Eric got in trouble because he was acting as a police informant. I've heard that from a variety of people. And also Eric himself, in his letters to his mom while in jail, he talks about how he was going to go, or he already had met with Steve Harris, and how he expected that would help him get out, and how his mom didn't need to worry about him, wasn't dangerous. So we don't know what happened, but for whatever reason, he ends up on the highway out there and is killed. And, you know, Eric Greer, like we said on the show, not someone I'd call credible. Like, he's not the guy that you would trust every word he says at all. But he's also not Josh Burrows. He's not someone who I could find evidence of telling just random, bizarre, scattershot lies like this. That wasn't what he did. And I still have never found a reason why he would tell this lie, especially not over and over again, like committed to it as he was. And he himself, he says straight up in his recorded statement, he doesn't know what actually happened. He just knows the things he saw and heard from others. But I do, whatever else happened, I believe that Eric believed the things he said and that he saw the things he said he saw.
And there's no benefit to him.
None.
For coming forward. And just to remind everyone, he came forward
About two weeks
after Renee's body was found. At the time, there's records of him coming to the police.
Or trying to. They weren't that interested in talking to him, but he tried to talk to them.
And then it was 2 years later he records the video. So there's nothing for him to benefit. There's no reward at that point.
There's only harm, like potential harm.
The first time I heard the Eric Greer video, the first time I saw it and heard it, I thought, who does he have an axe to grind here against someone? Mm-hmm. And you all have found nothing for that. So that to me was my first thought, but there's never been anything to come to light to suggest he has an axe to grind.
They were his friends.
Yeah.
Now, despite the fact, so the timing here is that statement that you've heard in the show was recorded in 2002 after Ty Lopes' conviction, but before Jake's trial. Despite that, that statement is never used in court. He never testifies. The sister story is never really brought up and never brought up before the jury. And in fact, it's only mentioned one time in the transcripts that we have. And it was from prosecutor Charles Schultz, who is talking in court. They're arguing over some motions they have. And he kind of out of nowhere says, there is a person out there named Eric Greer that some people said he was acting kind of funny. And when they're talking about some young girl, he says, shut up and don't talk about that. But there's no substance behind it. Now, that's not at all what Eric Greer was saying. Like, what he's talking about seems to be what Jamie, the sister, was saying. But he's obviously aware, the prosecutor's obviously aware that Eric Greer exists, but believes there's no substance behind it.
Could this be a strategy to make sure it gets on record so that years later it can't come back as new evidence or a Brady violation or anything? Like, I better just get this on the record now.
I don't know. It's a strange thing to bring up, and it's strange that it never got more attention. But at the same time, like, you and me, Jacinda, when we saw this case for the first time, the Eric Greer stuff, we're like, what is this? Like, okay, I guess we'll look at that.
It seemed both kind of too crazy to be true, but also, like, if everyone's talking about this, surely it's been vetted.
Yes. It's the sort of thing, it's like, if this was true, we would know. And since we don't know, it's probably not. Only in this case, it turns out it was never actually looked at, despite the fact that people were aware of it. If you're listening to this show, then I'm going to guess you're a fan of true crime podcasts. So in the mornings, grab your favorite mug and pour yourself a dose of spine-tingling true crime every AM with Morning Cup of Murder. It's a short daily show that's the perfect podcast to incorporate into your morning routine. In less than 15 minutes, you'll hear about a true crime that took place on today's date in history. Each day's dark history lesson will kickstart your morning with intriguing tales of murder, abduction, serial killers, cults, and more.
So, pour yourself a piping hot cup of murder every single morning with Morning Cup of Murder. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the 1970s and 80s, a monster hunted the Connecticut River Valley. 7 bodies found, 1 survivor, and no suspects. I'm Jane Borowski, host of Invisible Tears. I was 7 months pregnant and stabbed 27 times, and I survived. My story didn't end that frightful night. This attack on me physically and mentally lingered for years.
I'm Amanda Bedard, and I'm Jane's life coach and co-host of Invisible Tears. Jane is ready to share her story, and not just about her attack, but her healing process afterwards. As a platform for truth and healing, we are on a mission to help others that suffer from PTSD and help bring awareness to mental health issues.
To hear my story and others, you can find Invisible Tears wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
So we had a few questions this week, and one from Deb Klein on Facebook, and she wrote, "Every time Jake's trial is discussed, I keep shouting into the void, what's his defense doing? Still waiting to hear about his attorney, and why did so much happen in court slip by, seemingly unchecked?" And long answer short is that his attorney just wasn't really doing a lot. There's nothing particularly notable to talk about there, which is why you haven't heard much about it. She didn't do anything terrible. Like, there was no, like, flagrant notable moments of failure. There's nothing like that. There's just a lot she didn't do. And there is stuff she did right and stuff she was pursuing hard, I guess. And it wasn't like she was asleep at the wheel, but there definitely was a lot that just was never done. There's not really more of a story to it than that. She just didn't do it.
It's hard to know what a defense attorney's strategy is unless they sit down and explain it to you, right?
And she declined. Well, she didn't decline, but she never...
She said yes, but then that never sort of materialized.
Correct. And she did, I mean, to give credit, like, there were a few points that she did track down and have a good record in place. It didn't matter, but she wasn't doing nothing. Like, remember the two teenagers who told police that they heard Jake confess on the phone and admit to, like, beating Renee to death? And then at trial, they said they, you know, made it all up. She did track down all the records that proved that could have never happened because they were never out of juvie at the same time. So that, you know, that was something. It wasn't like she didn't care. And when I talked to her, she remembered the case immediately. She clearly believed Jake was innocent and that this one had gotten wrong. And I kind of got the sense from her that that was not a thing she said often in other cases.
It's hard also it's hard to know what happened in the courtroom just from a trial transcript. Right.
Yeah. Like, Jake says he was very frustrated with her. He felt like she was intimidated by the prosecutor, that she was never really fighting back. But I mean, that's his perception of someone who's never been in court like that before.
And he's also the one literally with his life on the line.
Mm-hmm. We also have a question from Sarah C.K. who wrote, "That was a crazy episode. What was up with that woman getting scared and hanging up on you when you asked her if her story happened on a rooftop? That was freaky."
There's been a couple comments from people, from listeners, about the rooftop and the hang-up phone call.
Yeah, so if you remember Karen Greer, Eric's mother, when I talked to her, she says the first time she heard about this case, or in connection with Eric anyway, is when Eric had spent a night hanging out a rooftop somewhere and then came home early morning hours just hysterical, like, you know, high, upset, couldn't really say much till he went to bed and they talked the next day. And I knew about the rooftop thing from that and other sources. And when I mentioned it to this witness, and this has happened a few times in this case, and I've learned to keep my mouth shut. Like, once the people I'm talking to learn I already know something about it, that tends to freak them out more than anything. Some people have been comfortable talking about it till they realize I'm already aware of things, and that's their cutoff point. I don't know why she got uncomfortable. There's nothing to suggest she was like heading to hide about the case itself. But yeah, she clearly had gotten a little bit spooked and didn't want to talk anymore. Now, as for what happened on the rooftop, we have heard a lot of stories in this case and a lot of stories of the sister story. We can't always verify the details. Often the details are wrong. So it's not always stuff worth airing on the show. In this case, the rooftop conversation, the rooftop night happened sometime in the week after Renee's body was found. So after Eric went to the house on Pastana Avenue and everyone there was acting weird. And it seems like what was happening is that on this particular night, no one on the rooftop was actually involved on the night when whatever happened. None of them were there. But they are all aware of something happening, and they're all kind of accusing one another or trying to figure out what happened. And they're sort of going around saying, well, you must have done it. No, you must have done it. But it doesn't seem like any of them actually knew who done it. But the conversation did leave Eric very upset, and clearly they all felt very strongly about what was happening. I don't think anyone in that conversation, though, had actual answers.
Yeah, and so when people find out that we know about these conversations have taken place, you can understand why someone might get a little freaked out.
Yeah.
In your mind, do you think it confirms that conversation happened on the rooftop? I mean, we've talked to other people.
Well, we already know that one happened from a lot of sources. So again, when you first hear about it, you're like, oh, what's happening on this rooftop? What's important? And I guess my conclusion at this point is that no one in that particular group actually knew enough to know, but they're also freaked out by what they do know. They're just kind of accusing each other and everyone's getting worked up over it.
But the bigger picture is what it means is that a little over a week after Renee's body is found, there are people in Manteca who think they know what happened.
Yeah. We also have a question from Mandy Manns on Instagram, who actually commented on episode 13 when we first talked to Tim Fisher. And she asked, interested in knowing whether Renee's friends have corroborated Tim's version of how they were known to each other. Just seems so weird that he was friends with the mother on Facebook and made himself the hero in the story by her getting drunk, etc. As you heard on the most recent episode, episode 14, Renee's friends did confirm that she and Tim knew each other. Amber was the main person in that group who also hung out with Tim. A few of the others knew of Tim as well, but most of them didn't actually have any dealings with him. But yeah, for Amber and Renee, it was not an uncommon thing for them to drive around town with Tim and his little Datsun and, you know, smoking weed and buying alcohol and cigarettes.
And she also said, though, that Tim never did anything that she felt was inappropriate with her. She never made advances or anything like that. And she didn't know about other people.
Yeah. And she kind of admitted that they were pretty naive. And she seemed really surprised when she found out how much older than he was, like nearly, not quite a decade, but getting up there. So yeah, that part's true. They were friends in that sense. They did know each other. They did hang out. And as Amber said, Renee would immediately get into a car with him if she wanted to ride somewhere. Yeah, and another thing Amber told us about that we didn't include in the show, we were telling her about the story Tim told us about the time that Renee had gotten drunk in a place they call the forest, and he'd had help carry her out because she couldn't walk, and she peed on his arm. And it was a whole thing. And Amber's response was, oh, she did that to Nick McGrand Mason, too, which is the guy that the ex-boyfriend of Renee that Tim says was also there. And we're like, wait, where did this happen? And we quickly realize it's the same story. And what's interesting is that Amber says she does not remember Tim being there and definitely does not recall him carrying Renee away. She had a very clear memory of Nick was the one who had to carry her out of the field. We don't know why their memories differ. And Amber even said, she's like, I can't say he wasn't there. I just don't recall him being there. But it was interesting to us that the story that has, as the question said, has Tim being the hero in it. Amber had no memory of that part.
But like you said, Amber said he could have very well have been there and I just don't remember it.
Yeah. Or he could have been watching from afar and saw this happen and, you know, retelling the story, inserted himself in the hero's role, which would not be uncommon. That's a thing people do often enough.
Unfortunately, we can't reach out to Nick to get his perspective, which could be an entirely third kind of memory because he died So it's Amber's memory versus Tim's.
People remember things very differently when you're talking decades on.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean they're lying. They just remember them differently.
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely have the experience with the bitch killer witnesses, which is what we refer to them as. It's the ones who Tim told us about first, actually, who had confronted him about rumors that he'd been seen with Renee before she died. And Tim told us a story about how, you know, they all three together had basically jumped him. We're going to beat him up. But then a magical crowbar appeared and he's able to fend them off. And I remember thinking at the time, I'm like, this story doesn't sound very real. And then I talked to a couple of people involved and they're like, no, that didn't happen at all here. Like what happened is like people were accusing him. People were saying he was seen with her. I confronted him. We didn't even fight. And then finally I find one of the people involved and he's like, oh yeah, Tim came back with a crowbar. I'm like, okay, so the crowbar thing is true. Circumstances sound different. I don't know whose version is the most correct, if it's Tim's or if it's Ernie's, but like,
it almost seems like two merged memories.
Yeah.
But some incident involving a crowbar and Tim defending himself against accusations.
Yeah.
Seems like it did happen.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the people that I spoke to in that neighborhood, they don't recall who told them a lot of what they heard back then. Or they say they don't recall who told them what they heard back then.
Yeah.
But they were very adamant. They're like, yeah. Everyone there, it was like, he was just seen with Renee right before she died. And I'm like, well, who saw them there?
And now almost 24 years later, they can't remember.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
But what we do know is that Jenny, she called the cops. She talked to the cops. She reported what she knew. She told us, for instance, she explained that like, she thought she knew that Tim hated women because she thought that Tim played pool sometimes at Ernie's sister's house. And she thinks now that they remember him making comments about women that showed he was misogynist from that. And then she remembers hearing people talk about, you know, him and Renee being seen together. And she thought she heard a story about him being jealous of her or something. But this far on, she doesn't recall that who was saying it. But she says she would have known for sure back then. If the police had ever called her back, she would have told him right away. So if she did know someone who saw Renee and Tim together, she could have told them the name right then. And they never called her.
The other thing about her story, though, also it doesn't seem like she had she didn't see them together.
She
herself.
Did not. She's certain she did not see them.
So
she'd seen Tim interacted with him. She knew something about him, like the thing about him hating women. She thinks she heard him talking at the playing pool, but she knows she didn't see Renee and Tim together.
It's another example of the rumor mill in Manteca.
Yep, yeah. Exactly.
But it's also interesting to note, though, that these two rumors, like the bitch killer rumors, that is entirely separate from the sister story. These people don't know one another. They're not aware of it. The people who know the rumors from the street level court, they were almost entirely, I think almost all of them, unaware of what was being said about the sister story. They hadn't heard any of that. They'd heard a separate set of talk that was just about Tim and nothing to do with the house on Pistana Avenue.
So two separate circles.
Two separate sets of rumors. And Tim's the only overlapping point.
Also, by the way, I would be very happy if I never have to say bitch killer again. That it felt like the episode, you made a point of making sure.
Oh, did I do that?
I said bitch killer.
I asked her to. I messaged her and Simon separately.
Did you? Thank you.
Make sure just
thank you for that. I probably said it about 12 times in the episode.
It's actually bitch killer. So
yeah, well.
I do remember, though, Jacinda, we were in the car together driving somewhere. And I was looking up, you were driving, I was looking for the lyrics of the song we just heard about. And I remember reading them. And I didn't imagine it was that bad.
Yeah, I think we were actually driving back to the airport.
Yeah.
And you were reading the lyrics out loud. And I too was like, what? Like, this is pretty bad. So.
And just, I mean, I don't know what Tim's thought process was, but to put that on your skateboard after your friend was murdered while possibly walking alone somewhere definitely seemed incongruent with the caring friend he tried to position himself as.
Yeah, but I think Ernie says it best where he's like, I'm not going to beat someone up over a sticker on a skateboard.
It was actually Chris.
Oh, it was Chris who said that?
Because Ernie did beat someone.
That's true. I got them mixed up.
Yeah, no, Chris was like, I don't care what's on a skateboard. Ernie was like, oh, I saw that and it was on.
I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things like, so he's got a sticker on his skateboard. Like, does that prove anything? No. Was it a bad choice? Probably.
So next week, we return to Manteca again and attempt to talk to Tim Fisher for a second time after learning more about him and the case and the sister's house in general, and find out what he'll say when we can ask better questions.
Now we're ready to meet with him and actually ask him about things that we've learned that we didn't know the first time we talked to him.
So come back next week for episode 15, which will also be the third to last episode in our series.
You've been listening to Proof Sidebar, a podcast by Red Marble Media in association with Glass Box Media. Send us your questions and comments at proofcrimepod@gmail.com. Follow us everywhere with the handle @proofcrimepod and on our website, proofcrimepod.com. Regular episodes drop on Mondays, and you can find sidebars on Thursdays. Thanks so much for listening.